Owen Brooks, and I'm with the Smith Robertson Museum here in Jackson, Mississippi, and I'm doing their oral history project. And I have with me this morning Judge Reuben Anderson from here in Jackson, and he is going to tell us a little about himself and some of his life history.
Okay.
So, Judge Anderson, do I have your permission to do this interview?
Absolutely.
Thank you, sir. Judge, start us off by telling us about your background, where you were from originally, maybe where your parents were from, and where your early schooling, etc.
I was born in Jackson on Dalton Street, which is out close to Jackson State. My parents, my father's name is Richard Anderson. He's from originally Hinds County, close to Bolton, the area called St. Thomas. My mother, Helen Anderson, she grew up in Rankin County. I went to school, started my early education at the Jackson State Laboratory School. Then I went to Holy Ghost Catholic School for a number of years and ended up going to Jim Hill, the public school here in Jackson. Graduated from high school there in 1960. My father was a bricklayer by trade. My mother was a homemaker. I have two brothers, Robert Anderson and Richard Anderson. Both of them are alive and live here in Jackson.
Give me your brothers' names again, please.
Robert Anderson.
Robert.
Robert is retired from UPS. He worked for UPS for a number of years in California and retired back here to Jackson. And my brother Richard was a school teacher and for some 30 years here in the Jackson Public School.
Are they both older than you?
Both are older than I am.
All right. Okay, do you mind saying what year you were born, sir?
I was born in 1942.
All right, and now as I hear it, you went to Holy Ghost, that was the elementary school?
Elementary school, and went to high school at Jim Hill High School, school here in Jackson.
Mm-hmm. And you graduated in 1960, right?
1960. After that, I went to Tougaloo College in 1960, and graduated from Tougaloo in 64, and attempted to go to law school at Ole Miss in 1964 and did not gain admission and went to Southern University in Baton Rouge for a year of law school. And in 1965, I was admitted to Ole Miss and graduated law school there in 1967.
Graduated Ole Miss in 1967. All right. Now, you were one of the early graduates from Ole Miss, as I can remember. Is that right?
I was the first African-American to graduate from the law school.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
In my 2 years at Ole Miss, there were 5 or 6 other students at Ole Miss during the time that I was there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, now when you were at Tougaloo, your remembrances of what was going on in Jackson during those were some difficult times, some hot years. Give us some, and Tougaloo was more or less involved in a lot of the goings-on of that period. Describe for the benefit of
when I went to Tougaloo in 1960, Mississippi was segregated. Every aspect of it was segregated. In 1961, Tougaloo was considered, I gather, the kind of the breadbasket of the civil rights movement. It was the only place that black and whites could assemble together without being arrested. Tougaloo was at that time where most of the civil rights figures would get together, Mega Evers and Jane Meredith and everybody else, to plan their strategies. there were two faculty members at Tougaloo that was intimately involved in the civil rights movement, John Salter and Ed King. And they were somewhat advisors to Mega Evers and the NAACP. And out of that, the Tougaloo College began the first sit-ins that took place in Mississippi, the integration of the library in Jackson. I was involved to the extent that I attended the meetings and was an encouragement to the students who participated. I was involved in some of the sit-ins that took place during that time, 1961 and 62. But Tougaloo College was instrumental in...
Do you remember when the Freedom Riders came, 1960?
Freedom Riders came in 1961, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
I grew up in the house of a lawyer named Jack Young.
Oh, yes.
Jack Young, when I say I grew up in his house, his son was my best friend. And Mr. Young's house was kind of the gathering place for the civil rights movement. He was the lawyer for the civil rights movement for the NAACP. In fact, he was president of the Jackson branch of the NAACP. And so most of my early childhood involved being paying attention to the civil rights movement and what was going on. Mr. Young, who was a prominent lawyer in Jackson, encouraged me to go to law school, encouraged me to be a lawyer, and assisted me in getting admitted to law school, both at Southern University and at Ole Miss, and he had a huge and tremendous impact on my life. He represented all of the civil rights workers and was involved in a lot of the civil rights activity, along with Jess Brown.
All right, and Jess Brown. Jack used to come all the way to the Delta to represent the community hospital in Mumbai.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that very well. Yeah, Jess Brown. Okay, was Cassie...
Carsey Hall was around during that time. Carsey and Jack and Jess were the three lawyers who did most of the civil rights work. Carsey continued to work at the post office after he became a lawyer, mm-hmm. and he was not as active as Jack and Jess in the legal arena. Mm-hmm. However, he was involved with the movement. He was president of the Jackson branch for a number of years. And,
the NAA.
The NAACP. And, but when I came back to Jackson in 1967 as a lawyer, there were five African-American lawyers in Mississippi. And the burden of the civil rights movement pretty much fell on those five lawyers.
Okay. Jack Young, Jess Brown, Cassie Hall, who else?
Sidney Thorpe was a lawyer. He did not do civil rights work.
Sidney Thorpe.
And that was another lawyer. Marion Wright was here, and she headed up the NAACP Legal Defense Fund office. And when I got out of law school, I began work for Marion Wright.
In the Legal Defense Fund?
With the Legal Defense Fund.
Okay. All right. Now, tell us, we were in 67, 68, and 69. Where were you? You were practicing?
I, in 1967, when I came to Mississippi, came back to Jackson, I began working for Marion with the Legal Defense Fund, mm-hmm. and I got drafted to go into the military,
and okay.
The Legal Defense Fund, I was in fact one of the only lawyers that was a member of the bar that could manage the Legal Defense Fund's business, and I was somewhat instrumental in helping that office run because Marion was leaving. She had told the people at the Legal Defense Fund that she would be leaving. And I was one of the few lawyers who was a member of the bar, and it was essential that I stay around in Jackson. But anyway, I moved and changed my local board and moved to New York City.
Oh, you did?
Thinking.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Thinking that if I moved to New York and changed my local board, that I would.
What year was that?
1967.
That was 67.
That I would not be drafted. And I did that, changed my local board to New York, asked the New York local board there if they would give me a deferment to practice civil rights law in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. That went on for a while, and they denied my request. I moved back to Jackson, I think this was in 1968, that but while I was living in New York, I worked in Mississippi. All of our cases were in Mississippi, and I would go back to New York on the weekends and spend my time down here during the week.
Now, were you actually in the Ink Fund office in New York while you were there?
I worked in the Ink Fund office in New York.
Oh, okay.
And lived in New York.
And that was Jack, who was?
Jack Greenberg was the director of the Legal Defense Fund, and Jim Neighbord was the associate director.
Right.
But most of the cases that we dealt with were cases that were school desegregation cases and public accommodation and voting right cases in Mississippi that we worked on. But at the end of the day, the New York local board declined to give me a deferment, and I came back to Mississippi, and thinking that I was headed to Vietnam, and decided to make my pitch to the Mississippi local board. And I did, made a presentation to them, told them about the fact that I was one of the few lawyers that...
Was that in the form of an appeal?
No.
To the local tribunal?
New York sent my papers back to Mississippi for me to report.
Uh-huh.
And I made a presentation and talked to the people in with the local board and explained the importance of an African-American lawyer in Mississippi handling these cases. And they gave me a deferment to practice civil rights law in Mississippi, which was surprising.
Mm. But, the local draft board?
The local draft board.
Oh, man. Yeah, that was surprising.
The chairman of that local draft board was a local car dealer named Jimmy Fowler. And,
the Buick man?
Buick dealer.
Yeah.
And I don't know what impacted him or why they decided to do it, but that's why I ended up not going to Vietnam and how
you're quite fortunate.
Practicing.
They drafted me in 51. Korean War.
Did you serve?
Yeah. Yeah, I went.
But I was thinking that I would go to Vietnam, and I thought I was wasting my time appearing before the local board, but they granted my request.
No, isn't that so?
So I spent about the next 5 years as a civil rights lawyer in Mississippi, along with Fred Banks, Melvin Leventhal, and John Nichols. We represented the Legal Defense Fund in a majority of the school desegregation cases in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And we integrated most of the state institutions, the state hospital, the highway patrol, you name it. We were instrumental in doing that, and we held public accommodation cases all over the state.
How long did you stay with that?
I did that all the way up until around 1973 or 1974.
Okay.
At that point in time, the relationship with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund changed. We were staff lawyers during that period of time and paid directly by the Legal Defense Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And as time passed on, funds for civil rights and school desegregation matters dried up, and the result was that I had to get out and assist our law firm in making money. And Mel Leventhal and Fred continued to do the civil rights work, and John Nichols and I started private practice, so to speak, and our law firm still did civil rights work, but we still did a private practice.
And what kinds of things did you handle in private practice?
I did all of the criminal practice and civil practice, and John Nichols did the chancery practice and title searches and things that. Fred Banks and Mel continued to do the civil rights cases, all of the school desegregation and public accommodation cases.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And from private practice, tell us how you got to be a public official. Yeah, well, you became a judge at some point.
Yeah, I was in private practice and all the way up until 1976, I think, and I was appointed by Mayor Russell Davis as a municipal court judge for the city of Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
And I did that for a period of time until August of 1977, and Governor Cliff Finch appointed me as a county court judge for Hinds County. And I served in that capacity, I think, until 1981. And in 1981, Governor
Wheeler... So you were appointed by Finch in 76?
77.
77. Okay.
And in 1981, Governor William Winner appointed me a circuit judge.
Okay. Who was that?
William Winner.
William Winner. Okay.
And I was circuit judge for the Seventh Circuit, which encompassed Hinds and Yazoo counties. And in that capacity, I handled both criminal and civil matters, and did that until 1985. And in 1985, Governor Bill O'Lane appointed me to the Supreme Court.
To where?
Supreme Court.
Supreme Court. Uh-huh.
And in 1986, I had a contested race for that office and won.
Were you filling a vacancy when Elaine appointed you?
I filled a vacancy of Francis Bolin, who retired from the Supreme Court.
And then you ran for your own time?
I ran for my own seat in 86 and was elected, I think, for a 8-year term. And I served until 1991 when I stepped down to go back into private practice.
Okay. Now, you served in the Supreme Court till what year?
1991.
Okay. And then you retired from the bench? Supreme Court. Okay. But you didn't retire altogether. Did you go back to private practice?
I went back to private practice. I went to practice law with the law firm of Phelps Dunbar, which is a regional law firm with offices in New Orleans, Baton Rouge, Houston, Tampa, Tupelo, Gulfport, and London. I do a civil practice representing companies that have problems mostly. I'm in the litigation section, and I do litigation and go to court. I anticipate doing that for about another year, and after that, I'll do something different.
Mm-hmm. Are you the only black in Phelps Dunbar?
No. Phelps Dunbar...
at least in the Jackson office.
No, we have probably 10 black lawyers in Jackson. Phelps Dunbar has been honored a number of times as the most diverse large law firm in the country. We have more African-American lawyers proportionally than any other law firm in the country.
Were they the first so-called white firm to admit a black as a member of their firm?
I don't know.
In Jackson?
No, not in Jackson.
Not in Jackson.
Phelps Dunbar prides itself on its diversity, and we make a big effort, and and have won national awards for our diversity.
Okay.
In addition to practicing law, I serve on the board of a number of public companies and have done that for years. The first board I went on was in 1978 when I went on the board of, at that time, First National Bank, which is now Trustmark Bank.
Trustmark.
I've been on that board since 78. I served on the board of, presently serve on the board of the Kroger Company, which is a large grocery company.
National chain?
National company located in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. I've been on that board since 1991.
Mm.
I serve on the board of Bell South, which is a...
Bell South?
Bell South, a regional telephone company.
Okay.
Based in Atlanta. I serve on the board of...
Ma Bell was broken up what year? Because that's the year Bell South came into into being?
Bell South came into being in 1982 when AT&T was divested of that company.
And you went on the board on what year?
1994. I've served on the board of Burlington Resources. I just went off of that board when it was acquired by ConocoPhillips about in March of this year.
Mm-hmm.
I've served on the board of Mississippi Chemical
Yazoo?
Of Yazoo City for
Yazoo.
4 years,
mm-hmm.
and they've been acquired.
Owen Cooper?
Right. And I think those are only boards I serve on presently. I serve on a private board of a company called Minac, which is a Job Corps provider.
Oh, yes. I think I've heard of it.
Yeah. And other than that, those items keep me busy, and I still stay busy with the practice of law.
All right. How about your family? How many children have you got?
I have three children. My oldest is Rosalind, who is a TV reporter for Channel 3 here in Jackson. My next oldest is a son, Vincent, who is still in school. He's in technical school. And my baby daughter, Raina, is a lawyer with the district attorney's office here in Hinds County.
Okay. What's her name?
Raina, R-A-I-N-A.
R-A.
And I have a grandson who's five, and my wife of 38 years is Phyllis Anderson.
Okay. And you said your two brothers survived?
Two
are
brothers?
Still alive.
Yes,
they're
they
older
are.
Than you.
They're older
still
than
here.
I am, and they're still here.
Well, sir, you have seen a lot of things happen in your time here in Mississippi, right? And I guess Mississippi has been important to change, not only here in the South, but all over the country. And it has set the standard for voting rights, most certainly voting rights all over the country, and for the integration of public schools, political parties. Comment on how you see the importance of change in Mississippi affecting other parts of the country, as well as Mississippi itself.
Well, I've seen a lot of change in Mississippi. As you would expect, growing up in the 40s and 50s, I experienced Mississippi when it was totally and completely segregated. I went to segregated schools. Drank from segregated water fountains. I've experienced Mississippi at its worst, and so obviously I've seen a lot of change. I've been a lot of first in Mississippi in terms of things that African Americans have accomplished, being the first in a number of positions on the judiciary. I've been president of the Mississippi Bar, which is interesting in the sense that in 1968, I, along with Fred Banks and several other lawyers and
went to integrate the bar, which was segregated at that time, and then some 30 years later to be president of the bar. I've served as president of the State Chamber of Commerce, which is the MEC, the Mississippi Economic Council. That entity was a racist entity for a long time, and whose sole interest was to make sure that African Americans were held down in terms of compensation and pay, and to be president of that entity shows that Mississippi has changed considerably. And the University of Mississippi, when I was there in the 1960s, it was a fiercely segregated institution, and today it is barely integrated, and it's on the cutting edge of mending the races here in Mississippi.
Now in politics, of course Mississippi has the largest number of black elected officials of any state in the United States, and that's in a that was accomplished in a relatively short space of time, if we're looking at history in its entirety. That certainly is a hallmark. Give us a comment on that.
On the politics in Mississippi, well, I was an elected official in Mississippi for about 14 years, although judges don't consider themselves politician. I was elected. I've been involved in Mississippi politics most of my life. I've run for public office. I ran for city commissioner for the city of Jackson in 1969. I've supported candidates. I'm supporting them today, in particular Congressman Thompson, who I think is essential for Mississippi. I co-chaired Bill Clinton's campaign for president in Mississippi in 1996. I think Mississippi's politics are different, unusual, and African Americans always have the opportunity to elect anybody on a statewide basis. And
you think that's possible? That hasn't happened. That's about one of the only things that blacks in politics here in Mississippi have not achieved, a statewide candidate that's been successful.
It'll happen. It'll happen real soon. I think Barbara Blackman had a great opportunity for lieutenant governor last time, and somewhat fumbled it away. But it'll happen. It's just that the electorate has to be energized behind the candidate, and we will find a candidate that we can become energized behind.
What do you think about the disposition of white voters to vote for black candidates? I can remember the time as well as you when that was next to impossible.
It happens, but it doesn't happen frequently enough that whites support black candidates. I think a lot of time we have candidates who run because of they feel that they've been called to do so. In a lot of cases, they are not the right candidates for the right office. And in politics, like everything else, money drives it. And unless a candidate has the resources and assets, it's highly unlikely that they'll get elected. Mm-hmm.
Distinct threat, I guess, Benny faces this year in terms of his reelection. How do you see that happening? I don't think too much of Mr. Espy's opposition, but they surely have set up a situation where whites can cross over into the primary election. White Republicans, per se, can vote in anybody's primary, and they certainly will, a number of them certainly look as if that they will try to support a candidate to defeat Benny. You want to make a comment for us on that?
Well, ever since Benny has been in office, he's had the burden of, so to speak, of trying to represent a district that is the poorest, one of the poorest in the country, and in doing so, he has to represent his constituency, which is a lot of poor and disadvantaged people. In doing so, a lot of white voters feel that he's not representing their interests. And he's had to carry that burden since he's been in office. But my feeling is that there's nobody in Mississippi that could represent the 2nd District as well as Congressman Thompson. He's totally, completely honest. He's ethical. He doesn't talk out of both sides of his mouth. And he's a huge and tremendous asset to Mississippi.
So you think he will prevail?
I'm comfortable that he'll prevail.
You are? Very good. All right. How about Congress? Well, the other congressional districts. What about redistricting? Were you at all involved in the redistricting that enabled us to have a black congressman, the first one since Reconstruction?
Yes. I was involved in that in 1991 when I, along with Bill Elaine, represented the state legislature in the redistricting of the state legislative districts and the congressional districts. However, the courts made the final blessing to those because litigation was pending, but I was involved in it in representing the Mississippi legislature.
Okay, you were representing the legislature. Mm-hmm. All right. Have we, and we've made considerable progress in getting blacks involved in, at that level? In the state legislature, the upper house, the Senate, and the House of Representatives there?
Yeah, I forget the exact numbers, but we've got,
I think 14 in the...
I think a total of 42...
42 altogether, something like that, 14 in the Senate.
Those numbers are great, and we've got some exceptional individuals over there, some very talented people, but overall, I think they're ineffective in terms of being productive and representing African Americans.
Were you disappointed to see the defeat of the tobacco tax and the doing away with the food tax here in the state?
Absolutely.
Yes.
I think that the governor is completely and totally wrong on that issue. I don't think it'll die. It'll resurface, and eventually I think the legislature will pass.
And what have you enjoyed most in terms of your public service over the years? What has given you the greatest satisfaction?
Greatest satisfaction I've had in my whole professional career was a period of time that I was a civil rights lawyer. Back in the 60s, I had the opportunity and the honor of representing and being a lawyer for some of the greatest people. I represented Aaron Henry, Fannie Lou Hamer, so many people that nobody knows and hears of their name, but they were just outstanding individuals who made Mississippi what it is today. That period of time was the most enjoyable for me.
Good. Very good. And public education. Where have you seen that go? I don't know. I think my wife is in the public education area, and she is very disenchanted with what she sees happening. Are you comfortable that the public schools here in Mississippi are doing their best as far as educating the young people?
They might be doing their best, but they're not doing a good job.
Not doing a good job. Okay.
I along with Fred Banks and Mel Leventhal, integrated a vast majority of the schools in Mississippi in the 1960s. And I don't know if we've made mistakes in that process of focusing too much on integration and not on local control. But I do know one thing, that our educational system, as bad as it was in a segregated sense, is not much worse today in terms of what people learn in the schools today. I know I went to the public schools in the 1950s, and the learning climate under these segregated schools were a lot better than they are today. And I know the world is different today, but...
Discipline didn't seem then to be a problem as it is today.
You know, discipline was not a problem, and I think that was a tremendous amount of dedication from school teachers during that time that we don't have today. And I think the respect and admiration we had for our educators was a lot more.
Do you think we put too much emphasis on higher education to the sufferance of elementary and secondary schools?
I don't think you can put too much emphasis on any part of education, but I'm not that excited about our higher education.
True enough.
But it's no question that our primary and secondary education system, if it's not broke, it's close to being broke.
Yes. Now, do you accept the fact that maybe the emergence of the white private school enterprise had something, contributed something to the demise of public education here in the state?
Absolutely.
Speak a little on that, if you would.
Well, as we integrated the schools in the 60s, white flight resulted in the private education throughout Mississippi. And when you take away from the public schools, the resources and assets, you weaken the public school. And there's no question in my mind that that's why we have the challenges in the public schools today, is that they're back segregated again.
Right.
And whenever you have anything that's segregated, it's suspect, and people look upon it as being inferior.
Inferior. Mm-hmm. How are we going to save it? This situation, because it doesn't get better, it seems to get worse. What you're thinking on that?
I don't spend a whole lot of my time thinking about public education, but I do know one thing, the one that I'm close to, and that is the Jackson public school system seems to be headed in the wrong direction. But I think a lot of these problems or the lack of the breakdown of the family. I think we don't have parents interested in their kids, and particularly interested in them getting a good education. And until we can get that involvement, and we're going to suffer with the same problem for a long time.
One other thought about quality education and how we define it in today's world, and what other countries do as far, how other countries do perform as far as their educational systems are concerned, and how we don't seem to be able to compete successfully on that front.
Well, it's true to some extent. I mean, if you think about it, you don't ever hear of anybody going to a foreign country to get a higher education. Everybody wants to come to Harvard and Yale and to America to get educated.
Well, they're still going to Oxford and Cambridge now.
And that's all.
That's all.
But for some reason, this country has a superior higher education system that is working. But unfortunately, the public schools of this country are suffering. They're suffering because poor and disadvantaged people are attending them. And when that happens, the quality and the perception is always that it is inferior.
That seems to beg the question about the impact of poverty and the impact of poor people on the elementary and secondary school education that's being offered. You seem to be leaning in that in the direction of saying that the we don't want to say the victim is at fault, but we haven't eradicated poverty. We haven't eradicated illiteracy here in Mississippi, in fact. We still have the highest rate of illiteracy of any state in the United States, and we could do away with that overnight if we wanted to, it would seem to me. How do you feel about that?
Well, my feelings about it, Arne, is that the people who run the country neglect the fundamental basis of what they're there for. If we shut down what we're doing in Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan for 1 month, we could educate everybody in America.
It would seem that way.
And you know, you spend $20 billion a month on a war, and you're spending a little of nothing on education and healthcare.
And healthcare here in this
country. It's our priorities are in the wrong place. And at some point in time, hopefully this country will elect people who have an interest more than dominating the world.
Oh, really? And there seems to be the need to restructure our value system here in this country so as to be able to deal more honestly with our own people as well as the rest of the world.
Well, for
has
some
materialism
reason...
materialism gotten the best of us?
For some reason, the people who... the Congress and the administration... for some reason, the whole emphasis has changed from doing something to just being in office. Everybody's emphasis is on being reelected. Once somebody gets to Washington, whether it's the president, vice president, congressman, or senator, the only thing that they're concerned about is staying there. And they will do whatever is necessary to stay in public office. They have no concern about their constituents. They have no concern about people who have not. They have no concern about the public health of this country. And I don't see that changing anytime. I don't see a leader that's I know about in this country that wants to address those issues.
Self-aggrandizement is the name of the game?
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, Reuben, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Arne.
For taking the time.
I've enjoyed the visit, and I miss seeing you. I don't see you. I didn't
Well, you know, I'm 78 years old. I'm not as fast as I used to be.
Oh, and you're 78?
Yes, sir. 78. I come here every day.
You look extremely well.
I managed to put in 4 hours, right, in oral history. And I've done 85 interviews in the last year and a half, so I stay busy.